He was a guerrilla fighter. Kimathi had been captured and executed. Kenya became the West's most stalwart pupil in Africa, a model of stability. Kimathi became a name on a street sign, thoroughly tamed for the tourists. And here, to see what Obama is getting at, we need a little bit of history. We need to plumb into the gory details of the Mau Mau uprising, one which scarred Kenya and also Obama's family. Historians wonder why the British were so brutal in suppressing the Mau Mau. The reason is obvious. By the end of the 19th century, the small island of England controlled a worldwide empire. It had to maintain this empire through a very small distribution of soldiers and settlers living abroad, outnumbered in every case by the natives. Edward Said points out that in 1879 there were 180,000 British soldiers defending an empire that spanned four continents, and one that was frequently in turmoil throughout India, Afghanistan, and southern and western Africa. Even through the first half of the 20th century, the British maintained vast regions of colonial territory with only the tiniest contingents of British military and administrative personnel. This meant that British settlers living abroad had very little protection provided by British soldiers and policemen. Mostly they had to rely on locals hired by the colonial administration, locals who were regarded as cagey and unreliable. So when trouble started, the settlers typically panicked and began to shriek for protection. "The natives are revolting!" And in Kenya, a fraction of the Kikuyu people did spawn a rebellion that was conducted in the name of Ithaca na Wayathi, land and freedom. They had a point. The British had seized the fertile lands of the Kikuyu and turned them into lavish plantations. The rhythms of Kikuyu life were severely disrupted. So the Kikuyu launched a campaign of murderous assaults not only against English settlers, but also against Africans and fellow Kikuyu who did not side with them. At its peak, this guerrilla insurgency had around 20,000 insurgents and was led by three men, Waruhiu Itote, known as General China, Stanley Mathenge, and Dedan Kimathi. Each of these three proved to be a savage and elusive opponent, and one, General China, actually survived the conflict and became a hero in post-independence Kenya. As the rebellion gathered support, it drew on the system of kinship oaths among the Kikuyu. The Mau Mau oaths, which became notorious for the gruesome rituals that accompanied them, were professed to swear loyalty to each other and to kill all white Europeans they could get their hands on. The preferred method of assassination was to kill entire families with a machete and then to mutilate their bodies. As these massacres were discovered one after another, a massive cry for help and immediate action arose from the settler community. There were shrill calls to the British government to wake up to the threat of the Mau Mau. Even today, the term Mau Mau is used to suggest fear and intimidation, as in Tom Wolfe's Radical Chic and Mau Mauing the Flak Catchers. The Mau Mau revolt in Kenya was portrayed by the international press as a kind of primitive African uprising, in which jungle savages were cutting people into pieces simply as an expression of their native barbarism. As white public opinion, both in Kenya and Britain, hardened against Mau Mau attacks, the British government went into action and brought in the Royal Air Force as well as several thousand crack troops to destroy the rebels and put down the uprising. The centerpiece of the British strategy was Operation Anvil, in which Nairobi was placed under martial law and army troops searched the city, rooting out Mau Mau guerrillas and their protectors. The presumption of the British, according to historian Wunyabari Maloba, was that every Kenyan was a Mau Mau sympathizer unless he could prove himself innocent. Maloba writes that families were separated as husbands who couldn't demonstrate their innocence were locked up in detention camps and their wives and children sent to congested reserves. From the perspective of curtailing the Mau Mau, however, Operation Anvil was an unqualified success. It drove the rebels out of the city and into the forests of Mount Kenya and the Abodare mountain ranges. Then the British expanded Operation Anvil into a broader campaign that targeted the entire Kikuyu community. Historian David Anderson estimates that at the peak of the emergency, the British held more than 70,000 Kikuyu supporters of Mau Mau in detention camps. The vast majority were held without trial. Altogether, some 150,000 Kikuyu were confined over the course of the rebellion. Historian Carolyn Elkins, in her own controversial book on the subject, notes that while the men were in official camps, the women and children were herded into enclosed villages, surrounded by barbed wire and patrolled by guards. Once I added all of the Kikuyu detained in these villages to the adjusted camp population, I discovered that the British had actually detained some 1.5 million people, or nearly the entire Kikuyu population. Elkins terms this system of confinement the Kenyan Gulag. Anderson doesn't use this term, but he notes that during the 4 years of the Mau Mau suppression, Kenya became a police state in the very fullest sense of the term. Some 1,500 Kenyans were sentenced to be hanged for collaboration with the Mau Mau in this period, and more than 1,000 were sent to the gallows. In no other place and at no other time in the history of British imperialism was state execution used on such a scale as this. And from cases that Elkins studied, we find horrible accounts of rape and torture in the detention camps. In some cases, Kenyans were subjected to electric shock treatments. In others, people had their private parts severed with a pair of scissors or pliers. Elkins spares us none of the details. And even when the British campaign against the Mau Mau finally ended, its aftermath is heartbreaking. It was not uncommon for men to come home to discover that their wives had been raped and had given birth to other men's children during their time in confinement. As for Dedan Kimathi, he was eventually hunted down by the British. The soldiers, many of them recruited from the Kikuyu, surrounded Kimathi's hiding place and wounded and captured him. After a brief trial, he was hanged on February 18, 1957, and his body thrown into an unmarked grave. With Kimathi's death, the Mau Mau rebellion was finished. Yet remarkably, although Kenya became independent only a few years later in 1963, few people remember the Mau Mau rebellion today. Jomo Kenyatta wanted no association with Mau Mau, telling the Kenyan people, "We shall not allow hooligans to rule Kenya. Mau Mau was a disease which has been eradicated and must never be remembered again." Not surprisingly, the British didn't want to talk about what had happened in the camps. India had become independent in 1947, and when the country's first prime minister, Nehru, heard about the British atrocities in Kenya, he complained to the former British governor general in India, Lord Mountbatten. Nehru's complaint made its way up to the prime minister, Winston Churchill. But Churchill had no interest in opening up an investigation into British abuses in Kenya, and so the book on colonial atrocities against the Mau Mau was officially closed for the moment. At this point, we can better understand Obama's determination to get that Churchill bust out of the White House. While the literature on the Mau Mau crackdown makes for gruesome reading, in a sense, it is not unique, because colonial powers have always used their power to crush such revolts. In India, for example, the British brutally suppressed the so-called Sepoy Rebellion in 1857 to 1858. But that was 150 years ago, while the Mau Mau suppression ended in 1960, only a year before Obama was born. It is one thing to read about these atrocities, and quite another to experience them. For Obama, these were not academic wars or war crimes for classroom debate. They were real wars and war crimes whose scars were endured by his grandfather and father. Obama's grandfather, Hussein Onyango Obama, served as a cook for the British Army in Myanmar, then called Burma, and Sri Lanka, then Ceylon. Later, he provided domestic help in Kenya in various British households. The British often called him boy and coolie and subjected him to routine insults. He may even have suffered greater indignities. Historian David Anderson writes, "Kenya's settlers regulated their African labor through a version of the old English master and servant laws and defended their right under this legislation to administer corporal punishments to their domestic staff and farm laborers. Anderson writes that flogging was common in Kenya, while it was very rare in neighboring British colonies like Uganda or Tanganyika. Onyango was arrested by the British authorities in 1949, just as the Mau Mau Rebellion was starting. He was accused of being a rebel sympathizer. The charge was prima facie dubious. Onyango belonged to the Luo tribe, and the Luo were not on good terms with the Kikuyu. Even so, there were some Luo who were part of the Mau Mau Rebellion. We read, for instance, in B.A. Ogot and W.R. Ochieng's Decolonization and Independence in Kenya that the Mau Mau raiders of Athi River Prison in 1953 included a contingent of Luo combatants. Still, that was 4 years after Onyango's arrest, so he could not have been one of the collaborators. According to one of his wives, Sarah Obama, Onyango was beaten until he confessed that he was, in fact, a Mau Mau collaborator. At this point, Onyango was left without food for days, and occasionally British soldiers showed up to poke him with sharp objects or squeeze his genitals between metal rods. Onyango saw some of his fellow prisoners die from torture. Others simply disappeared and were never heard from again. When Onyango finally returned home, according to Sarah, I saw that he was now an old man. One might expect that Obama Jr. would sympathize with his grandfather Onyango, especially upon discovering his abuse at the hands of the British. Interestingly, Obama has no such reaction and treats his grandfather with scathing contempt. The reason emerges soon enough. Sarah Obama, whom Obama calls Granny, tells him that once Onyango was released, he left the city and became a rural farmer and goat herder. There he began to speculate on the source of the white man's power. What your grandfather respected was strength, Granny says. Onyango began to tell his family and friends that superior knowledge was the source of the white man's effectiveness. He would even suggest that whites had conquered the world because they were better organized and more competent with technology than blacks. The white man alone is like an ant, Onyango liked to say. He can be easily crushed, but like an ant, the white man works together. Black men are not like this. That is why the black man will always lose. Africans, he feared, were headed nowhere because of the inherent lethargy and stupidity of the native people. The African is thick, Onyango would sometimes say. For him to do anything, he needs to be beaten. It is not hard to see that, after Obama heard this, he was basically done with Grandpa. Obama writes, I had imagined him to be an independent man, a man of his people, opposed to white rule. But now Obama had a totally different perspective.